We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us, and we're also very happy to have back on the program once again Rick Karch from Rick's Automotive Service in Champaign. Periodically throughout the year, we have him on the program, and he is here to answer questions. We can talk about preventive maintenance, kind of things that you want to think about no matter what kind of car you have. And if you have seasonal questions, you can do that. But more generally, the idea is if you have some kind of problem, and you're not quite sure how to solve it, you call us, tell us what kind of car it is, give the best description that you can, and Rick will see if he can help you out. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And if you want to send us email, you can do that too. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. Hey, thanks very much once again. For being
glad to be here.
I appreciate it. Something I was sort of thinking about was how it is now over time, the number of miles that you can go between oil changes has seemed to get more and more stretched out, at least with newer cars, that it seemed like, you know, at one point maybe we were talking about 3,000-4,000 miles, then we went to, well, maybe 7,000 miles, and or there are some cars I think you can even go
15,000.
More than what made that possible? Is it the oil? Is it the way that the car is made?
Well, the cars that have the extended oil change intervals are using synthetic. And some of them have oil life monitoring devices that monitor temperature of the coolant, engine RPM, how long the car is driven, various parameters to establish the life of the oil. The general consensus has always been 3 months, 3,000 miles. But obviously with the synthetic oil, you can go longer. Yeah. I don't like to see them go more than 7,000 miles on the synthetic oil. I realize some of the manufacturers do state greater, but with today's engines, particularly the camshaft controls that we're using now are utilizing oil pressure. And there's very small orifices, O-rings, and any little deposits that accumulate in the oil lubrication system, in the oil pan, is where they usually generate, or in the cylinder head, flake off. And those little pieces are suspended in the oil, and they're, of course, flowing everywhere. Uh-huh. And they create problems with some of these systems. And on some of the cars, these camshaft control systems are referred to as VANOS units. Every manufacturer has different terminology for it. But some of them, by the time you replace the unit, parts, labor, you know, you can be well over $1,000 to $1,500. And that's one of the downfalls of these long oil change intervals, is starting to see more of that. And a lot of the manufacturers that initially started out with conventional oil or non-synthetic oil are switching to synthetic oils. The synthetic oil is superior in lubrication characteristics, the viscosity or the thickness of the oil. Doesn't change as dramatically as it does with conventional oil, meaning when it's cold, it's very thick. Mm-hmm. And lubrication to the upper end of the engine, which is where the camshafts are, is really critical. First startup, in particular in the mornings. So a lot of people switch to synthetic oil. It is more expensive, but in the long run, it's cheaper.
So if you go longer between oil changes, that maybe somewhat makes up for the difference in the cost.
Right. Guess. And then the wear in the engine is considerably less.
So you don't, nowadays you don't have to worry so much about, it seemed that there was a time when we thought about different weight oils for different times of the year, depending upon whether it was hot or whether it was cold. So you really don't do that anymore?
No. Most manufacturers are utilizing a 0W something oil. The number is the viscosity rating of the oil. The lower the number, the thinner the oil. The higher the number, the thicker the oil. Mm-hmm. And a lot of manufacturers are going with a 0W20 now, 040, some give 520, but they're all fairly low, thin oils. It decreases the rotating resistance of the engine, increasing mileage, and obviously why they're going to those oils.
Yeah. So now, so the solid stuff, the particulate matter that ends up in the oil that can be a problem, where does that come from?
Well, a lot of it is just deposits of combustion processes that get past the piston rings and then get into the oil. And if the oil gets to a certain temperature, it can actually bake itself on to components or stick to components. Typically ends up in the oil pan. And that's the one thing you want to avoid, is the oil does break down and doesn't lubricate as well, doesn't clean as well, and obviously that doesn't protect as a result of that.
Okay. So now for you, bottom line is you recommend every 3 months or at what kind of mileage?
Well, usually 3,000 miles for conventional oil.
Okay.
I mean, if you want to stretch it a little bit, that's fine, but I wouldn't be. And, you know, there's always the question of which one's more important, the time or the mileage. And that's kind of an individual process, I think. People that take short trips, that's really hard on oil. And the reason being that every time you start the car, you probably have noticed out the tailpipe there's little drops of water that come out. Well, that's a byproduct of combustion. It is water. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you get the same water condensation occurs in the engine. If it never really gets to operating temperature, as it partially starts to cool back down, condensation forms, and that's water. And, of course, it gets into the oil. So if you're taking short trips, then maybe you should consider the 3 months. If you're taking long trips and it always gets to operating temperature, you're on the highway for more than 20 minutes, then you can, of course, go by the mileage. So the best thing to do is just follow the manufacturer's recommendations. I know a lot of them will say 10,000 on conventional oil, and that's just too long.
Rick Karch is here. If you've got car care questions, give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send us an email, you can do that too, will-illinois@illinois. I think I got that all screwed up. Give us a call, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. The other thing I thought I would talk again a little bit about is maybe talk about tires. And we talk about that in the wintertime when there's snow and ice on the road, and that's really important. But I guess I'm thinking about the fact that, you know, lately we've had a lot of rain, so there may be people who are driving in conditions that are wet. And their, you know, tires are real important, too, because you want to keep your car on the road. Just, again, talk a little bit about what you're looking for if you're trying to gauge the condition of your tire.
Well, the number one thing is tire pressure. And tire pressure is checked first thing in the morning. It's never checked when the tires are hot or after you've driven them. As you drive a car, there's friction between the rubber and the road surface, and that generates heat. And the heat expands the tire pressure and escalates the pressure itself. So you want to check the pressure's cold. Where do you find that number? Usually it's on the driver's door jamb. When you open the driver's door, there's a little sticker there. And it may be a little confusing when you first look at the sticker because it'll list different tire sizes and different pressures. But those are the tire pressures that you want to follow. If it's not on the driver's door, sometimes it's in the gas cap door, or it's in the owner's manual, of course, as a final resort. As far as tires are concerned, visual observation, look at the sidewall of the tire. Are there any cracks in it? If there are cracks, it's time to consider replacing them. It's kind of a rubber dry crack in appearance. The other thing is the actual depth of the tread of the tire. When you look at the tread, in between the tread, you'll see a little bar that goes from one side of the tread to the other where there's a little gap. And that's referred to as a wear bar indicator. And that wear bar indicator, as it nears the road surface or the outermost portion of the tread of the tire that remains, when you get down to around 2/32nds, you should consider replacing tires. Now, tires start out, it depends, anywhere from 10 to 12/32nds of tread depth. And it's, if you can't see the wear indicator, just walk to another tire, you'll see it. And you just, every once in a while around the circumference of the tire, down in the tread, in the bottom of the gap, is where you'll see that wear bar. The other thing when you're looking at that is, does the tire look even in terms of wear? Is there more wear in the middle? Is there more wear on the outside? Is there more wear on the inside? Or is there more wear on the inside and the outside? And tire pressure dictates excessive wear, for example, in the middle. If we have excessive wear in the middle, that means the tire is overinflated. So it's like ballooned or crowned. If it's underinflated, it's going to be concave, which would be too low tire pressure. If we have wear on the inside of the tire, that's an alignment issue. That's referred to as camber. Camber is the inclination of the tire as it tilts in at the top or tilts out at the top. Camber is a smooth wear. Wear that is sawtooth, if you run your hand to the inside of the tire and you run your hand to the outside of the tire and it feels jagged in one direction, that's an indication of toe. Toe in or toe out. Toe in's like pigeon-toed, or toe out. And those are usually visual as well as you can feel. And spare tire is important too. I realize some cars literally don't have a spare tire, but those that do may have a small tire. Mm. And you need to check the pressure of that tire, because the one time you need it, a lot of times they lose air because nobody checks them. Yeah. And fortunately, a lot of the manufacturers now are starting to put tire pressure monitoring sensors on the spare tire.
Oh, so you will. It'll something on the dash will tell you that the spare is.
Well, it won't tell you it's a spare. It'll just. No. It typically will just tell you there's a tire low.
Oh, okay.
A light may come on.
Okay.
Now, some cars do designate which wheel is low. So that's a good thing. So if you have a car without a spare, you definitely need to keep an eye on tires.
Yeah. All right. We got a couple callers here, and I have an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. That's the, I don't know why I couldn't bring that out of my brain this morning, but that's the one for the email if you want to send us a message that way. And if you want to call, 333-9455 and toll free, 800-222-9455. And we'll start right in with some callers. Piatt County. The first, and this is line number four right here.
Oh, hello. Good morning.
Hi.
I have a 2002 Honda CRV with 212,000 miles on it, and it's been such an excellent car, but this past year I've put over $4,000 in it. So I thought maybe I should start looking, and over the holiday I saw at a used car dealer that was closed, 2006 Honda CRV, really great shape, body shape. I mean, you know, the body was, I couldn't, of course, look, it was just locked. But, it was $16,000, and it had 53,000 miles on it. And so what are some intelligent questions that you ask? I've never done this before myself, to buy a used car. When you go in, what do you look? Can you take it to a mechanic and have them look at it, or do you ask questions?
Well, the number one question would be, they should be able to provide some kind of maintenance records, particularly oil change intervals, maintenance intervals, and particularly on a Honda every 10,000 miles, as you know. Is this a car that is a local car? Did they get it at an auction?
Okay.
If they got it at an auction, I definitely wouldn't consider it.
Okay.
Because
do they have to tell you that? I mean.
Well, if they won't tell you that, then I would probably just excuse yourself because,
okay.
I mean, they need to be honest with you if they're selling a product. And if you're not getting answers you're comfortable with, then I would let them know that. But as far as having it inspected, definitely have it inspected. I have yet to see a used car lot or a dealer that wouldn't allow vehicles to be inspected. And I mean, they may say, well, we've already done that and everything's fine. You say, well, I'm going to take it to someone that has serviced my car in the past and I'm comfortable with them and their quality of work, and I'd like them to look at it since they're going to take care of it. And They'll be more than happy to let you do that. I know a lot of them will even deliver the car to the shop for us to check it. So,
okay.
So that's never an issue. But the reason that I mentioned about where the car came from, if it came from an auction, usually what an auction is when a dealer takes a car in on trade, for example, your car with 212,000 miles, they're not going to put that on the lot. They're going to take it to the auction and get the best price they can.
Okay.
And cars that go to an auction are usually cars that have high mileage or have mileage and or in need of repairs that are costly. And it doesn't make economic sense to the dealer to fix the car because they're not going to get the money back out of it. So they go to the auction. So that's why I would stay away from a car from an auction.
Okay, well, that's a good place to start. Thank you so much for your help.
You're welcome.
Okay, so thank you. So then if you're considering buying a used car, say, from a local dealer, you say to them, well, can you tell me where this car came from? Was it driven by somebody here in the area? And then you say, and do you have service records, or can you show me the record of service in the car?
Yeah, and they should be able to produce that. The other thing you can do is just go out and open the glove box and get the owner's manual and the maintenance manual and look through it. The maintenance manual should be documented. And the other thing, when you're looking at a used car, it's kind of a tough thing to evaluate. But my feeling is let's say we have two cars, and we have one car that has 40,000 miles on it. It's an 06. And we have another 06 that has 80,000 miles on it. Well, typically, the higher mileage car is a highway-driven car. And highway miles are easier on a car, in my opinion, than in-town miles. So if it has 80,000 highway miles on it, that's, in my opinion, about 40,000 in-town. So you can pretty well divide that number by two.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if there's maybe only $1,000 difference, $2,000, or maybe even more between the two vehicles, and the higher mileage might be a better deal in the long run, even though it has higher mileage. And then you have to, if you're looking at a high mileage car, the other thing you have to consider is, how long am I going to keep this car? If you buy a high mileage car, you better plan on keeping it, because you're not going to get your money back out of it quickly until it kind of works out. Used to be 15,000 miles per year was average. Now I think it's down around 10,000 or 12,000. So you can kind of use that as a guideline when you go look at a car, too. The other thing, when you look at a used car, you just walk around it. Does it look okay? I mean, do all the gaps look the same on all the doors and the panels? And lift up the rubber around the doors or across any of the molding around the windshield, do you see paint underneath that, which is an indication that it's been repainted? The other thing the dealers, any selling dealer, should provide you is what's referred to as a Carfax report.
Mm-hmm.
And a Carfax report is usually extremely accurate. What it does is it shows when the car was first sold, who it was sold to, or not necessarily who, but where it was sold, the mileage. And look at the mileage increments, and you can kind of see a pattern there. And if you see something irregular in terms of mileage, where, you know, 1 year it got no miles put on it or something like that, that should be like a little flag. You know, maybe something happened to the odometer, the speedometer.
Mm-hmm.
People don't turn speedometers back very much anymore that I run into. I mean, it used to be a practice, but not anymore. It's hard to do, for one thing. So the other thing that's excellent resource is Consumer Reports. It'll outline year, make, model, and it'll have what I refer to as dots and circles. And they're colored in different manners with regards to dependability, high incident of repairs. And those are excellent. I mean, you go down through those and look at them. The other thing that's good is they'll have a section where it'll say, use cars to avoid, and it'll break down ranges on cars that they feel are good purchases in the long run. And I've found it to be extremely accurate.
All right. Rick Karch is here with us from Rick's Automotive in Champaign. He's here periodically on the show. We talk about car care. And if you have a car problem, give us a call and tell us about it, and he'll see if he can help you out. We'll go next to Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning.
Yeah.
Okay, in terms of oil, I have a Toyota four-cylinder. Is that versus a six-cylinder? Is there any difference in regard to, or they come out about the same? Understand what I mean or not?
In terms of mileage?
Well, the problem is that I drive it mostly in town, so I do try to stick to this thing of 3,000 miles or 3 months. So is any extra in regard, or any, is there a greater problem with that, or are they about the same, a four and a six?
The same.
The same, okay.
Yeah,
the second one, in terms of what's your feeling, what's this one where they, rather than put air, they put something else in the tire?
Nitrogen.
Okay, do you like that, or is there upside, downside, or how do you feel?
It's
supposed to vary, right, in terms of pressure, it's a little more.
That's correct.
Okay, is that the only advantage, or?
Well, they advertise you're going to get better mileage, but yet I don't understand how that is possible, as long as the tire is inflated correctly.
Mm-hmm.
There's no moisture in the tire, but, I have a problem with when they charge a lot of money for nitrogen.
Oh, okay. The other one, I think it's wonderful with this sensor for that spare tire, because what happens is you end up having a flat and then you realize.
You don't have a spare.
Yeah, you don't.
Right.
Okay, great program.
All right, thanks. So just one more on this, in case anybody's confused about this nitrogen thing. There are some people who sell nitrogen to inflate the tires.
Yes.
And the idea is that it expands and contracts less than regular air does. So the idea is, no matter what the ambient temperature, if you've been running the car for a long period of time, theoretically, the temperature, the pressure of the tire should essentially stay more constant. Is that the idea?
Well, there's a lot of claims, and I don't really feel it justifies the expense.
Hmm.
A lot of times it'll be a selling point in terms of tires, but I just don't think it's a big selling point.
So in your car, you just have air in your tire?
Correct.
Yeah, okay.
Right.
All right. 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. You got car questions, give us a call. I have an email from somebody here, and this is actually about paint. And the person writes, I've never gotten used to these new paints. He says they're extremely easy to scratch as they're put on very thin, and I've found that those touch-up paints sold in automotive supply stores leave annoying bubbles. Am I doing something wrong, or are these new paints meant to keep automobile dealers in extra profits? There you go. What do you say? What do you think about paint?
Well, I've always thought that the newer paint, I don't know what year he's referring to or she's referring to, but it seems to me the newer paints are more durable. They have a clear coat over them. So there's actually a clear film over the colored paint.
Mm-hmm.
So they seem more durable to me. You get little scratches, and as long as the scratch isn't deep, it can be sanded out. So I'm not sure. And as far as the touch-up are concerned, a lot of the touch-up paints, referring to the ones in the bottle with the little brush, if you don't shake them properly, and you will get air in the, and kind of run the brush across the top of the container before you actually touch the area you're going to paint, you may get some bubbles, but usually they don't match perfect. So
yeah.
It's a really hard thing to match paint anymore. Even body shops, it's difficult. They have mixing machines that actually weigh the drop by drop individually of paint and colors, and then they have cameras that actually shoot pictures of the paint to try to match it as best as possible. And you still, even painting a car, if the pressure's too high, too low, it's going to change the color as well.
Hmm.
So getting back to nitrogen, nitrogen is... One of the other big advantages to nitrogen is there's no moisture in it. And that's all we use in race cars is nitrogen. So from that standpoint of consistent tire pressure builds, it's very good for that. And usually when they put nitrogen in a tire, they'll put the valve stem cap will be green in color. Okay. Now, if you're low on air and your tire needs air and it has a green cap, don't get excited about trying to find somebody that has nitrogen. Just put air in there. It'll be fine. It's not going to hurt anything. So.
Okay. Are there now, if you buy a new car, are there manufacturers that from the beginning that put nitrogen in the tires? Or is
I'm not sure.
Sort of an aftermarket thing for your average consumer car?
No, I wouldn't consider it aftermarket. It's been around for a while.
Oh, okay.
So,
but there's nobody that when you go, you buy a new car that it rolls off the lot. It's going to have nitrogen in the tires.
I'm not sure. There may be, but most of the ones that I deal with, no.
No. Okay. Caller here in Indiana. Let's talk with them. Line number 4. Hello.
Hello. Two things. First one, I just come in and you were talking about some service where they had dots, they were different colors, and they would give you information about different cars and models. I was wondering, was that a Consumer Report thing or something else?
Yes, Consumer Reports, that's correct.
Is that their annual automotive issue?
Yes.
Okay. My second question deals with struts. I have a family member, who is bound and determined to drive her car until she really needs the struts. And they're making noises now just on a regular asphalt level road, the little bit of vibration stuff you get. And I'm concerned about the safety of the struts. I know next to nothing about struts, I know about their construction and stuff like that, but I don't know about whether or not they can be taken to a place where they would break, get stuck together or something like that would cause some problem for her driving.
What is your understanding of a strut?
Well, these are in the rear, and that the ones I think I remember correctly are sort of they're not cylindrical, they're more square, rectangular shaped, and they have some kind of hydraulic system set up with them. And they braced against the car and against the close to the wheel.
Okay, so
they're making the chunk, chunk, chunk sound, you know.
Okay, well.
And it started some time ago, and I kept talking to her, and like I say, she, I get every ounce out of her car, and I'm concerned about the safety, and I know next to nothing about that part of it when it comes to the struts.
Yes, well, basically a strut. Do you remember what shock absorbers were?
Yeah, yeah. That's where I'm coming from.
Okay. Well,
that's my period,
Well, that's okay. That's basically what a strut is. It's a shock absorber. They've just termed it McPherson strut.
Yeah, because, that's right. I remember that now, yeah.
Because the shock...
cars, yeah, in England, yeah.
Right, because the shock is contained with inside the spring.
Yeah.
So it's a smaller mass, less unsprung weight. As far as struts or shocks are concerned... when they go bad, you may have seen this, a car going down the highway and it looks like the tire's bouncing off the ground.
Yeah.
That's because the shock or the strut is completely gone. It's typically filled with oil or gas.
Okay.
And when that fluid or gas is lost, the shock is designed simply to maintain contact of the tire to the road.
Right.
In any condition. Now, yes, they do make noise at times, but usually a noise associated with bumps in a particular corner, whether it's front or rear, can be a sway bar,
okay,
a sway bar link, a sway bar bushing. Mm-hmm. It can be an upper strut bearing or bearing plate, but usually it's not the strut itself.
Okay. Okay.
So sometimes you can bounce the car and duplicate it. Have you been in the car when it makes this noise?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've been with it from occasionally to now that it's almost not the constant, but it's always going on, even down a good city street.
Okay. Does it do it more so, or do you hear it on small cracks in the road, and when you cross a small crack in the road, is it a double knock, meaning a knock when
no,
we first
that I haven't heard. The only thing I've unusual to me is when you go from like one level to another level that's curved, like you go off the street onto a entrance to a service station, and the way they've, you know, you've done the asphalt copy or whatever, you got a roll, then a dip, then another roll all at the same time practically. Mm-hmm. That's when I first heard it was talking about, and that was some time ago. And I say now it's progressed to the point where it's pretty constant going down a good, you know, even a recently asphalted street in town.
I see. So is it a double knock, meaning you hear it when you first hit the crack and then you hear it after the crack?
Yeah.
Okay. Usually double knocks are related to sway bars.
Okay.
You'll get as the spring is being compressed, mm-hmm. you'll hear a noise, and then as it extends, okay. you'll hear another noise. If it requires a pretty significant bump, then it's usually related to the strut top bearing.
Okay. Now, what you're saying, we're talking mostly about sway bar then.
If it's on very, very small cracks or bumps, yes.
Yeah. Okay. But, well, thanks a lot. Yeah.
But I mean, if it's
now,
making...
Is safety factor okay? Because I may just have to get the damn car and take it in myself.
Well, as far as safety is concerned... After you hit a bump, does the car want to change lanes or anything?
No, that has not happened. No.
Okay, all right.
It stays true there.
Okay, so that if a car was to change lanes, that would indicate there may be a ball joint issue, a suspension bushing that actually changes the direction of the tire, and therefore the car changes direction.
Okay.
If the shock is totally gone, usually what you'll see if you run your hand around the tire, you'll feel cupping or high and low spots.
Yeah.
And if you don't feel that, then it's usually not a shock.
Okay. Okay. Well, thanks a lot.
All right. Very good.
I'm armed with some information.
Okay. We're talking this morning with auto mechanic Rick Karch. We're taking questions on car care. We'll talk more in a moment after a short break. This is Focus.
Support for WILL comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods on the corner of 6th and University in Champaign, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of foods from around the world, including cheeses, olives, spices, hot sauces, olive oils, and more. World Harvest invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here with 10 different topics for you every week. Tomorrow, it's First Wednesday. Doyle Moore will be here at 10 talking about cooking. We've been doing that for a long time, and we're now into summer, so we'll talk about cooking outside on the grill. Also tomorrow in the 11 o'clock hour, the guest will be Seth Fletcher. He's a senior editor with Popular Science magazine. We will talk about his new book, Bottled Lightning, Super Batteries, Electric Cars, and the New Lithium Economy. And then Thursday at 10 o'clock, we will talk a little bit about the history of the Peace Corps, just turned 50 this year. And our guest will be Stanley Meisler. He's a former foreign and diplomatic correspondent for the LA Times. He's also former deputy director of the Peace Corps Office of Evaluation and Research. That was in the mid-60s. And he has a new book out, When the World Calls. That's a history of the Peace Corps. We're here weekday mornings from 10 to noon. If you'd like to check on the schedule or listen to past programs, go to our website. That is WILL.illinois.edu. In this hour, the guest is Rick Karch from Rick's Automotive in Champaign. And if you have car questions, you give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Didn't get an email here from someone who wants to second your doubts about nitrogen. Here the person writes, air is 79% nitrogen. He says it's a gimmick. The only advantage is that there's no water in it. And parenthetically says, maybe. I don't know that really is. Does it really make much difference that there wouldn't be any water vapor
in there? Oh, yes, definitely. That's why I mentioned on the race car.
Uh-huh.
That's all I use.
Okay.
Because I know there's no moisture in there.
But that's pretty extreme conditions when you're racing. So probably for even on the highway over a sustained period, I wouldn't think you'd get to the kind of temperature in your tires that a race car would.
No. Like when I'm on the track, you know, I might generate 6 pounds of tire pressure. And on a street car, you'd be lucky to see 2.
Yeah, I mean that is that it would go up that much over the time that you'd be running the car.
Yeah, because you'll get the tire pretty warm.
Yeah,
upwards of 200 degrees.
Oh, yeah. All right then.
So.
Well, some other callers here, and let's see what'll be next. How about Matt Toon, line number one? Hello. Hi.
Hello.
Yeah.
got two cars, a 2009 Ford Focus, my wife's car, and I have a 2001 Ford Taurus wagon. The wagon only has about 29,000-30,000 miles on it, and the Ford Focus has about 4,000 or 5,000, the 2009. One question regarding the oil change. I do want to ask about tires, too. But the local, I take it to the local dealer for oil changes and their 25-point checkups or whatever it is. And they recommend and put a label in the windshield to change oil every 6 months on both cars. And the cars have been in a heated garage all winter. And on the tires, I did change tires, bought tires for the Ford wagon when it was about 27,000-28,000, because I thought I saw a few cracks on a couple sidewalls. But the Ford Focus was only 5,000 miles on it. I was just curious if you have an opinion on the 6 months and when I ought to think about watching the tires on the Focus.
Well, the 6 months, they've probably done that because, as you know, you're not driving the car a lot. And when you do drive it, it's usually a short trip because both cars are fairly low mileage cars. As far as the tires on the Focus are concerned, you're bringing it in on a normal scheduled interval. So one would conclude that they're looking at the tires when they look at the vehicle and they're rotating them. Do you have, how many times have the tires been rotated on the 09?
I think it's due next time I go in.
Okay. All right.
I think
good.
That's one of the recommendations.
Yes. Okay. Well, that's good. So if you visually look at them and they look okay and they tread depth seems fine, we talked about that earlier. Are you aware of the wear bar indicator on tires? And it's basically located in the gap between the tread that contacts the road down inside that groove. There'll be a little wear bar that goes from side to side. And as that wear bar indicator nears the tread of the tire, as it gets to around 230 seconds away, then you need to consider replacing tires.
I should check that every time the oil's changed?
If you just ask them to measure the tires for you and document it,
I think they do that each time.
Okay, well, that's good. That's good.
On the oil, then, that 6 months is would be suitable for this situation.
Yes.
On the tire pressure, the station wagon, as you can probably tell, it's not driven much at all. And my son wants to do some driving with it, and I checked the tires last week, and they had 28 pounds, all four of them. And I thought probably if we drive that car a little bit, it'll probably come up. So a few days later, well, I took it around town and ran a few errands, and it was a warm day, one of those warm days. And then I checked the pressure when I got back, and it was 34, which is on the door.
Yes. Well, that's a cold measurement, not after you've driven the car. So you want to check that before the car has been driven. Whatever the tire pressure on the door is what the tire should be set at cold.
Okay, well, cold. It was 28, but when I got back on the trip, it was 34.
That's correct. It would have been.
Yeah, but isn't that normal then?
It's normal for the tires to build in pressure, but the starting pressure that's on the door is the starting pressure before the car has been driven.
In other words, it ought to be 34 when it's cold, sitting there cold.
Exactly.
Well, isn't it going to build up to about 36 or 38 on a trip?
Yes.
But that's normal.
Correct.
Okay. Well, I thought maybe I'd just leave it alone because it's after run around town, it got to 34, and that was on the side of the door. So I thought, well, that's okay.
No, that's when you look at the door, it'll say cold measurement.
And okay.
Tire pressures, you know, if you check it on a 40-degree day, it's going to be lower than it's going to be on a 80-degree day.
Yeah, well, this was in the garage, and it was probably 60.
Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Very good. Other calls here, and got a couple of people here in Urbana. Oh, no, we're going to go to Muhammad next. We'll do that. Line two. Hello.
Yes, I have two questions. Mm-hmm. The first one is that I have one of those little tires in my trunk, and I bought one of those tube things that you're supposed to inflate it with at the time you need it. Do I need a connector of any type to do that, or is that little gizmo enough?
Are you talking about, like, inflate a tire or fix a tire or fix a flat in a can or what?
Yeah, it is one of those cans you buy, which I bought. Is that enough? Does it hook right onto the tire and fill it up, or do you need a connector of some kind? Do I need to buy something else?
No, it should already have that.
Oh, so you're all set if you've got that.
It should be all set. If you just, there should be directions on there.
Yeah.
Is this one that has sealer in it?
I don't know. I just bought one of the things they recommend to fill your tire if you're caught on the road.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And it's a tube, you know, it's a can type thing.
Right. Well, the reason I mention it is a lot of those have a sealer in them.
Oh.
And if you have a tire and it goes flat, and by the time you get out of the car, if you can hear air hissing out of the tire, that's not going to fix the tire.
Yeah.
You're going to have to replace it with the spare on. And then if you ever do use any kind of additive that you've mentioned that has a sealer in it, you need to let whoever you take the tire to for repairs know that that sealer is in there, because they need to remove it.
Well, if you're caught out on the road,
you do what you need to do to keep going. That's correct.
Yeah.
Exactly.
The second thing is that my radio went out, just went out. So I bought a fuse, and that didn't solve the problem. And the guys on Car Talk said to a lady who had the same problem, they said, "Do you see a wire down below?" And she said, "Yes." And they said, "It's that wire that's fallen loose from the radio." Now, I don't feel any wire. And when I talk to guys about my radio problem, they say, "You got a big problem."
Well, I wouldn't call it a big problem. Does this clock maintain time?
I'm sorry?
Does the radio maintain time? Does it have a clock in it?
Yeah.
Okay, does the clock work?
No.
No.
Nothing works.
Nothing works. Okay, there's two fuses. There's a fuse that I refer to as a terminal 30 fuse, which means it maintains constant battery supply to the radio. And then you have another fuse that's terminal 15 that comes from the ignition switch. So when you turn the car on, you can push the button, the radio will come on. You can push the button, the radio goes off. That's terminal 15. The battery fuse is the one that keeps the clock on all the time. So in other words, if you go out, and your clock is always flashing 12 or whatever, and then you have to always reset it, then you've lost that fuse. You need both of them.
Okay.
And if both of them are okay, then you may need a new radio. And used radios are pretty easy to acquire.
Now let me ask you, which fuse is that other fuse? Because I replaced the one that said radio.
Well, a lot of times there's also a fuse on the back side of the radio, which you can only access when you remove the radio.
Okay.
Okay.
So it won't necessarily be on my fuse box.
No.
Unfortunately, I'm in trouble unless I take the radio out.
Usually the cigarette lighter is the same fuse as a radio.
Oh, well, my cigarette lighter works.
Okay. But next time you have it in somewhere, you might just ask them to pull the radio and check the fuse on the back side of it.
Okay. Is that expensive?
Well, it depends on the car.
Yeah.
Some cars, it is. It sometimes takes an hour to pull a radio. Some cars, you can have it out in less than a minute.
Mm.
So it varies.
This is a 92 Chrysler LeBaron that only has 49,000 miles on it.
Mm-hmm.
So would that be easy or hard, or you don't know?
I'm not positive.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Just, I want to clarify one thing, though. Just if you have one of these small, the spare or your emergency tire is not a full-size tire.
Correct.
Though that should always be inflated.
Yes.
Yeah. So you shouldn't have to. I mean, the idea is you shouldn't have to inflate that at the time that you need it. I mean, it's supposed to be ready to pull out and put it on and ready to go.
On some cars, that's true. On some, you do have to inflate.
Oh, okay.
But generally, it is inflated and ready to go. And you only get one. I always get a kick out of when I see cars going down the road. I saw a car one day that had three of those on it. Three of those. Now, where did he get them from?
Yeah. They had friends. Can I use your little wheel?
Yeah. And then the other thing about those, they'll always have a speed rating on them.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're not supposed to go above a certain.
Or more than so many miles.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. So then with these pressure air and sealant in a can that's supposed to help you if you got a flat, is it that it's just it can only deal with such a tiny puncture, and if it's really bad, it's not going to do it.
Okay. No.
All right. Very well then. Let's go to line three, and that would be Urbana. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
My question is about changing oil in my car. I have a Honda, a 2004 Honda, and I heard a discussion, I think it was on the radio, about using synthetic oil, and if you use that, it stays cleaner longer, and you don't have to change the traditional, change that as often as a traditional oil. I did ask the Honda people about that, and they didn't seem to know anything that I was talking about. And I'm sure they like to change oil because they make money. So do you know anything about the synthetic oil and where you go to get that?
You can get synthetic oil at any parts store.
Any what?
Parts store. Or if you take it in for an oil service, they usually will have synthetic oil on hand as well. The synthetic oil, you are correct, you can use it longer, leave it in the engine longer, upwards of 7,000 miles. It is about twice the price.
Uh-huh.
So, but you are correct. It is superior to conventional oil.
Uh-huh. So,
in the long run, it's a wise choice.
Okay, so how long you say 7,000 miles. So would
yes.
that be a couple of years?
Well, it depends on.
Well, I only drive about a couple thousand miles a year.
Then I wouldn't switch to synthetic.
You wouldn't?
No.
Oh.
You should change the oil once a year.
You should at least change the oil once a year.
If you're only driving 2,000 miles, yes.
So that's just the ordinary oil.
Correct.
Once a year.
There is no advantage to you to have synthetic oil.
Okay.
It's going to cost you more.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, I'm glad to learn that. Thank you very much.
You're
okay,
welcome.
Very good. Well, I have another email question here from someone who writes on their 2002 Outback wagon. It's got a four-cylinder engine. Just began to idle roughly, to run roughly, and the check engine light comes on. We put gas in it as it was low and thought that moisture may be in the tank. It ran fine that day. We didn't drive it for a day, and today it began doing the same thing. It runs rough. The check engine light's coming on. Any ideas what could cause this?
Well, Subaru, typically, the check engine light, they didn't mention if it was flashing or not.
No.
But if the check engine light is on, the engine runs rough, the check engine light usually will flash. A flashing check engine light, you should not be driving the car. It is a severe misfire, meaning one cylinder is not firing, whether it be lack of fuel or lack of spark or compression. And the first code you're going to get when you scan this particular Subaru is going to be P0300. That's just going to be a random misfire code. The next code after that would be a P0301, 02, 03, or 04. The last number represents the cylinder number that is misfiring. So they need to get the car scanned as soon as possible. And like I said, if the light is flashing, they really shouldn't be driving it, because you get severe misfire, and what happens then is it obviously idles rough, it accelerates poorly, it lacks power, but raw fuel is going into the exhaust system and damaging the catalytic converter because the raw fuel escalates temperatures in a catalytic converter, and it can damage the converter. Catalytic converters usually are around a $1,000 part. So they need to have this addressed to determine if it's an ignition problem or an injector problem. A lot of Subaru problems are wires or coils, typically.
Okay. So that I would think, no matter what kind of car you had, if the check engine light comes on, you should pay attention to it.
Yes.
It's not the kind of thing you should. And I'm sure that there are, as you say, there are a lot of cars that would say, you know, depending on what the light says, or depending on what the light is doing and what your owner's manual says, it may in fact say, yes, don't, you should not be driving the car. Now, I don't know what happens if you're headed down the, you know, the interstate and your check engine light comes on. I guess you pull off and you put in your flashers and you stop.
It's okay to drive a car if the check engine light is on. It's not okay to drive it if it is flashing.
Okay.
Now, we should, I know we don't have a lot of time, but I just want to make sure, clarify what check engine light means.
Okay.
It doesn't mean you're out of oil, you're low on oil, your engine is overheating, you lost a belt. It doesn't mean any of those things. What it means is, of all the different sensors that the computer monitors, it expects to see every sensor in a certain window of operation. And if that value from that sensor is too high or too low for a set period of time, then the light comes on. And when the light comes on, you obviously need to get it evaluated because there's something wrong with one of the sensors that the computer looks at. And if you don't get it fixed, that's always the question. Well, what happens if I don't fix it?
Hmm.
Well, you'll never know if there's another problem that may leave you stuck. Check engine lights that come on and go off, that does happen. And usually when a check engine light is on in town or off in town but on the highway or off on the highway, it's usually an oxygen sensor. And some cars have four oxygen sensors. So you need to know why the light is on, if it's on, yes. But if the light comes on, it's okay to continue. If it's severe enough, it'll start flashing. Sometimes the light will come on and it may quit running too. But it needs to be evaluated.
All right. Well, there we'll stop for this time around. Rick Karch from Rick's Automotive in Champaign occasionally is here, and we talk about cars. Thanks very much.
Thank you.